Hello, everybody. Dr. Lonnie Stewart here from the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast. Are you a physical therapy student about to start studying for the National Physical Therapy Examination? Or maybe you're a professor, a program director, or a clinical instructor who teaches DPT students preparing for the NPTE? Either way, we would recommend checking out our sponsor, NPTE Final Frontier, and the community they've built around preparing for and succeeding on the NPTE. That exam and the preparation that goes along with it can be long, tedious, difficult, and stress-inducing, but it doesn't have to be. NPTE Final Frontier has the tactics and resources to help address all of the usual barriers. They even have scholarships to help with NPTE study courses, FSBPT registration fees, and even research opportunities. And if that's not enough, they're even donating to the very first annual HET Podcast Scholarship to be awarded at the end of every year. Go to npteff.com for all of the details and use code HET for 10% off all purchases. Links to both the NPTE Final Frontier and their scholarship options are available in the show notes. And now, let's get ready to learn.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. F. Scott Feel, and I've got with me today longtime friend, Dr. Chris Hartness. Chris, how the heck are you, man? It's good to catch up with you. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you. Good to see you. Yeah.
Chris and I went to undergrad together at Wake Forest, where eventually I stumbled my way from English major into physical therapist, and Chris went on to become a doctor and a radiologist at that. So, Chris, tell us a little about your educational journey and how it's led you to where you are today.
Yeah, Scotty, it's been a journey indeed. I kind of have to start the story with, I remember listening to one of your podcasts, and one really jumped out at me as I was perusing the list. And it was the one about failures. And I think that's a good place to start to, I think there were several people that were defining what failure meant for them. And I think it's just part of the journey, really. And more, I think more just step back or reevaluation point or retackling point, but really it's just learning point, right? And especially in our fields of work and our trade, it really is just kind of, over time, the big goal that I've noticed happening, I don't know if endpoint is the right word, but transitioning through is that mostly we get comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah. That's why they call it practicing medicine, right? We never perfect it. You never end. You just keep throwing yourself into new situations.
Right. Keep learning new things as we go. Yeah. To make a long story short, I didn't get into med school the first attempt out of undergrad. So I went to a year of grad school with our good buddy, Mike White. And our goal there was to, I actually went and sat down with the deans of the med schools at Carolina and Wake. And they were gracious enough to let some random undergrad trying to get into med school have a one-on-one interview with them. Basically, I was saying, all right, so here's myself on paper. What else can I do to jump into this? And they said, yeah, grades are not as good as they should be, but everything else on paper is fine. So check out these grad school programs, either 1 or 2 year, and they're called post-baccalaureate certificate programs. And a lot of times they can be used as stepping stones into master's programs, PhDs, med school, things like that. But basically it was more or less kind of like the grad school program was a proving ground to say that, all right, here's basically the first year med school curriculum. Are you going to get A's? And so that's what we did. We just studied all the time and said, all right, well, yeah, here's the work and we can figure this out and we can do the work and the discipline of doing the work. And so I did that for a year and then it was time for me to go play Army. I did an ROTC scholarship at Wake and a long, cool story. I'll save you all those neat details because I would be rambling on for a while. But basically went on to do that for a while. And then after a year and a half, that's when I applied for the second time into med school was after the completion of that grad school full curriculum of a year. So I had all those grades now on my resume and then was able to apply into med school and got into two different schools and went to Richmond Medical College, Virginia, And so I'll just continue down the timeline. So going into med school, well, before med school, it was this idea of, all right, how can I best contribute to society? How can I best serve? What can I do to help? And I think that should be probably the big banner in front of every school everywhere from kindergarten through post-grad is, all right, look, you're not going to enjoy every subject. Nobody is, but you're here to learn the discipline of just getting stuff done. All right, you don't like it? Fine. But again, just the discipline of doing it, of getting it done. And that's the learning. You may not learn the subject all that well, but you're going to learn the subject of internally, okay, how do I just get this done? And how do I coordinate with teachers, peers? So in other words, vertically and horizontally, and how do I just get the work done? And then eventually through that process, you know, something magic might happen that may open a door that you didn't know existed, such, you know, for example, oh, I used to hate this subject and now I kind of like it, either because of my peers or because of my teachers or because of some thought process that came up in the learning process. Or conversely, you end up really digging into the stuff that you already knew that you liked.
Yeah.
So I think the other banner is underneath the just discipline of doing work and learning discipline for ourselves is, what do I really enjoy that I can also help people with? And I think that should be the overall banners in front of every school, right? Is that,
yeah,
welcome. You're not going to like everything. Your goal is to figure out, what do you dig that is going to help people? And, you know, the word help is as big as the word world, right? I mean, yeah. You know, there's so many facets to that.
You know, you hit on a lot of things there. I want to unpack a little bit of it, Chris, because one of the things one of the things I've been going into a lot lately in the business world is Ikigai, right? And I don't know if you've seen Ikigai, but it's essentially what you love, what the world needs, what you can be paid for, and what you're good at. And where those four intersect is Ikigai, right? And it basically, like you said, if you really find what you truly enjoy and what you're passionate about, I like to call it your zone of genius.
Yeah.
That makes it so much easier to get up and go to work every day and serve and have a bigger impact, right? Because that's the thing. It's like, if you really want fulfillment, you've got to find that thing that ignites you and makes you, you know, passionate and makes you push even when times get tough, because that's what's going to change the world. Like, seeing one patient at a time is great, but like, how can I have a bigger impact? How can I teach or educate or help many instead of just the one-to-one model? Not that it's wrong, but like, the way that medical field is going and reimbursement is going, like, we're getting paid less and less and less. And so seeing one patient, you know, at a time per hour or whatever isn't enough. So now you've got to come up with other ways to kind of show your real value to the world. And that means making that big impact, right? And it's funny that you mentioned, like, well, you might not like this, but maybe a magic opportunity happens, right? I was going to be outpatient ortho bro for life. I was going to be the New York Mets physical therapist. That was my thing. And then all of a sudden life threw me some curves, and like, I got put into like some geriatric settings, and I came to find that I really love working with the geriatric population. And that's who I've specialized with over the last 10 years of my 15, 16 year career. So it started out one direction, but the opportunities led themselves to me trying something I wasn't sure I'd even like. And now I love it, you know? So it's amazing that's what happens there. And the one final thing that I want to kind of touch on is just, I love how you turn this failure into success story and like kind of spun it. Like, you know, I didn't get into PT school my first attempt, right? But that was also because I was an English major and I didn't have a lot of the prereqs. So I knew I had to like do that. So I graduated with the BA in English and then had to take a full year of prereqs just to get into PT school, you know?
Yeah, right.
So, exactly. And again, I love the fact that you look at it as more of a positive spin and an opportunity to learn and grow, because I needed that first off. But B, it's really not a failure unless you just stop and give up. You know, if you're still learning and pushing and trying to push the boundaries and get comfortable being uncomfortable and being that lifelong learner, you don't really fail. You know, you may have some times where you get knocked off the horse, or, you know, you got to dust yourself off, get back up and do it again, you know? And I love that's a part of your story as well, because that it just goes to show, like, look, man, if you really want this, if you're into it and this is what you want to do and you're passionate about it, there's a way, you know, there's a way.
Usually for, I think, yeah, for most folks, if we are really latched on to an idea of I can get this, I really enjoy it, there are opportunities for us to figure out, all right, well, all right, so this avenue of approach didn't work.
Right.
I'm gonna try a different one.
Yep.
Yeah. There's a very common practice in medicine called, well, we share cases all the time with each other, live on the spot, after the fact, things like that. And that happens a lot. There's a ton of communication behind the scenes, again, live and after and pre, in the form of, let's take it one by one, live, yeah, with cases. And it happens every single shift where I find something and I'm thinking to myself, I don't know what this is, or I've never seen this before. And that's after practicing this stuff for 15 years. And every physician will tell you that's very common.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can't know it all the time. We know how to find the answers though, and that comes back to what we were originally saying of being comfortable with being uncomfortable. We're at this point in the stage in our professions and our trades, we know how to figure stuff out if we don't know the answer. And so live, yeah, I'll call on my peers all the time and we'll share cases and say, hey, check this out. What do you think about this? And after the fact, we'll have a bunch of cases where we'll share with each other across the board. In other words, many radiologists will share cases on like, hey, check out this neat case, or check out this great call by one of our peers, or check out this missed call by one of our peers. And all of it we review and say, we're learning on each of them, learning about, okay, so there was a missed fracture over here. Okay, now we can, look at this area in the future. It's all about learning and just
Yeah.
gaining experience all the time. Yeah, there's a lot of points to touch on. I think we're going to end up going back and forth quite a bit here, Scotty, but yeah, that's a big point, is that for encouragement for anybody that wants to go into this profession or is already in this profession, to know that even at the highest levels, man, we're all just human.
Yeah.
We're just figuring things out as we go.
Yeah.
And that is, science is questioning and communicating. So communicating those questions, communicating, well, here's some possible answers. Here's our experiences with these weird little nitpicky
Yep.
things. And also the overarching themes of what we were just talking about, the ikigai,
Yeah.
and also it really is just kind of learning all the time. That graph, that linear graph, stays linear. And that's what I've noticed through the whole process over the past 20 years, with undergrad and then grad school and then med school and then an internship and then residency thereafter, is that that graph doesn't change. There's just as much learning now as there was back then.
Yeah, I tell my students all the time, like, look, we're going to give you the gold standard textbook stuff, but when you get out in the real world, most of your patients are not textbook. They're going to have little differences and intricacies and, things that are just weird or different that you haven't seen after many years of practice. So, like,
Yeah.
it's okay not to know it. It's okay to collaborate, and that becomes a big deal, especially,
Oh, you're gonna
interprofessional
we're gonna have
collaboration.
to. Yeah, we have to. Yeah, all the time. And that collaboration comes in the form of personal research on, okay, I see this, I'm gonna go find some papers on it right now because I'm in the process of reading this image set. Yeah. And that's
So,
calling. I even call some of my friends across the country sometimes, is like, say, hey, check this out. This is a neat case. What do you think about this?
yeah, I love that because I've got, the good news is I don't know it all and I'm okay with that, but I know who does, right? I know the guy or the gal to go to because they're the expert in it or they're specialized in that area. So I like having go-to people, like experts in their niche, right? So you mentioned, that a lot of times there is a lot of learning to be done, and we do it interprofessionally and cross collaborations and whatnot. But let's go back to med school. Let's go back to, you know, you just mentioned the path that you had to take to get to become a radiologist. What were some of the things that you felt were like best practices when you were learning radiology in school? Like what were some of the ways that you helped, you know, you found very helpful in your learning process?
So the pre-story on that is, right, you've got, I'm in med school, and I remember it very succinctly because everybody says, well, how did you become a radiologist? And so the story goes, yeah, you're in med school. There's not a lot of exposure to radiology per se in medical school. I went to a med school that has the traditional format of the first 2 years, we are entrenched in classwork and also a lot of multiple times a week in between and after the classes, learning our clinical skills. So that's with mock patients, that's with each other, learning the physical exams, things like that, you know, the basics. And then in our third and fourth year med schools, you know, we are in rotations in the hospital. So we're essentially junior interns just figuring out, okay, this is how clinics work. This is how a hospital works, my role in it, and what my role is supposed to be and going to be in it. And so through all that, we had one of our deans in our med school, Dr. Messmer, was a radiologist, and I remember him very fondly. Occasionally he would show some radiological studies, but he wasn't focusing on radiology. It was more or less just entwined into what we were learning. And I remember him saying, you know, yeah, if any of you decide to go into radiology, it takes about 2 weeks. So I remember, and that's what I still use to this day, is his quote is, yeah, you know, it takes about 2 weeks. But that, you know, joking aside, I mean, it is it's the longest non-surgical residency. It's 5 years.
Yeah.
Well, internship plus 4 years. And then if one chooses to do a fellowship after that, then that can be 1 to 2 years after that. So either way, so going back to med school, I'm in my third year, and I'm in the middle of my medicine rotation, which is generally just internal medicine, taking care of very sick patients in a hospital setting and a clinic. And I remember not enjoying it whatsoever. I just wasn't clicking with it. And at that point, I was thinking, oh, well, that's nice. I don't like internal medicine, and I'm in medical school. Oh, boy. What is that? And so my buddies, we were all in rotations together, and they were like, Hartness, relax. We got surgery coming up next, and then we've got, you know, things after that. And I was like, okay, cool. All right. So get past medicine. And, you know, we're rounding on patients all the time. And the same thing in surgery. I really enjoyed surgery. And the surgical specialties was close to going into those because I thoroughly enjoyed it. But I did notice that with rounding on all the patients on all these inpatient services, patients that are in the hospital, so they're sick, you know, they need doctors. I noticed that in the rounding of all these patients, that when we talked about whatever imaging they had, I was thinking to myself, wait, what do you mean the head CT showed that? What do you mean the chest x-ray showed that? What do you mean the abdominal pelvic CT showed that? And so I would go in and say, wait, what is, yeah, let's look at that. Like, what, let's not just breeze past it. Like, let's look at it. And then I realized, wait, isn't there a doctor who does all that? And so the rest is history. And going back to, I'm not going to call them failures. I'm going to call them opportunities for learning. So another opportunity for learning happened several times. And there's kind of an asterisk for this because I was in the Army in my training. So I didn't get into residency the first, it took me 3 times to get into residency. Again, there's kind of an asterisk because they've got like this different point system and things like that. But each step of that way of my attempting to get into residency was another learning opportunity. So straight out of med school, I think I was the only person in my class of 180 or so that, quote, did not get into residency or, quote, did not match. That didn't bother me one bit, though, because I knew that the Army had a system that was a little bit different. And I was thinking to myself, no, I'm going to do this. Like, I get this and I dig it and I'm going to do this. And it wasn't like a me standing on a pedestal kind of thing. It was just like, all right, let's get it done. Yeah. And so did my internship in Texas. And at that point, it's like, all right, you know, we're in the groove. I'm just going to learn all I can. I'm going to apply to residency again. And at that point, then I'm up against other Army physicians who have either already done a residency or, you know, already have time in the service. So they've got more points. So I knew I wasn't going to get in that time. And so then I get slotted to a flight surgeon position that was elsewhere in Texas. So I got to work with Apache pilots and ride and Chinooks, help those guys out for a year, which was really cool. I was basically just a basic clinician for a bunch of healthy folks, a bunch of healthy, cool people that had a lot of cool stories.
Yeah.
So I got to hang out with pilots and their crew for a year. And that's when I got into residency, which was that third time. And that process was really neat, just going to interview over and over again and got the residency slot at the place that I wanted to go. And that was, 2010 to 2014. And so in residency, you just dig in. And because work is, it's been fun the whole time, and now it just gets more fun. And the residency that I went to, we didn't have sonographers after hours. And so as a resident, it was a lot of fun because there was no staff in house. I'm the only quote radiologist in the hospital as a resident. And so there's no sonographers. So I'm literally running down the hall to ultrasound patients and running the patient back to the ER and then running back to my reading room and catching up on everything that else that has been stacking up while I've been ultrasounding a patient. And then that's where I get to collaborate with all of my ER buddies that are residents and all the inpatient or medicine and surgical buddies, because we all know each other and we're all working with each other and hanging out after hours, everything. And so I get to talk with those cats and then we discuss, all right, it sounds like you've got these four ultrasounds and these four CTs, which ones do y'all want read first? So basically I'm triaging and saying, all right, what's the stack order of what you would prefer? And then we get to collaborate and do everything. So I'm the boss just running the show, and then it's fun. After residency, I'm a staff physician, radiologist in the Army for 5.5 years. I finished my obligation time. I get out of the service, and then I go to a fellowship for abdominal imaging. The reason I chose abdominal imaging is that in the service, I mean, we did a ton of musculoskeletal because it's the Army, right? Yeah. So there's going to be a bunch of dinged up joints and banged up bodies and things like that. So I felt really comfortable reading those MRs, obviously the x-rays. Neuro, we did a bunch of neuro, so I felt pretty comfortable in that. But I didn't feel like we saw a whole lot of pathology in the abdomen, pelvis, chest area. So I said, yeah, let's just go and do that. And that stems from talking with the guys that I was working with. I noticed that I was working, I was one of 10 radiologists in Georgia in that Army radiology facility. And two of my colleagues stood out as I thought being just better overall radiologists than the rest. And those were the two guys that had been to a fellowship. One had been to a breast fellowship and one had been to a neuro fellowship, and they were just a little bit sharper.
Yeah.
I think professionally just more well-rounded, just put together well. And their patient interactions were tip top. So I noticed that. And so I asked both of those guys, hey, should I go to a fellowship? And they both said, absolutely. You're going to learn more about whatever topic you want, but maybe more importantly, you're going to learn alongside the head honchos of these fields,
yeah.
The folks that are writing all the books, writing all the papers, and they've been exposed to so many cool cases that they can figure things out. And so then you collaborate with the surgeons, with the oncologists, with all these folks.
Well, and it's a self-development process too, right? You're seeking out even more education after all the education you've already done.
Oh, it never stops.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the learning never stops. Again, it goes back to that linear curve. And so what was really cool about going to a fellowship after being staff for 6 years is that I remember thinking, you know, this is going to be neat. I'm going to learn a lot from the residents, because the residents are going to be book smarter than I am because they're studying for the boards.
Yeah.
So they're going to know more nitpicky random association syndrome details that I've forgotten. But what I'm going to be able to bring to the table for the residents is experience.
Life experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Just work experience, life experience. how to work with patients, things like that, procedural skills. So it was a really neat back and forth learning. And I think this is really important that there's no such thing as really a hierarchy anymore. There's not, at this stage, there's not a hierarchy. It's all level. And we're all just going to play off of each other all the time. And that is really neat concept because it makes me realize that, okay, I might have something to bring to the table, but I'm not going to flout it. We're all in this together.
Yeah, it's like a good jam band, right?
It's a great jam band. And yeah. It really is that kind of communication of, oh, that's a neat idea. Or, yeah, oh, that's a good point. Let's play with that. Let's pull that in. And I think that another major theme that I've learned along the way is that this is not about me. This is not about a title. This is about helping. Yep. This is what can I bring to the table that helps people out? And so there's no pride in the game.
Yeah. Pride I left my ego at the door a long time ago, man. It's all about the patient. And now for a quick shout out to our newest sponsor, Varela Financial. If you're a physical therapist and you have student loan debt, you got to talk to these guys. What makes them unique is that they view financial planning like running hurdles on a track. And for PTs, the first hurdle many of us run into is student loan debt. Varela Financial will help you get over that hurdle. They not only take the time to explain to you which plans you individually qualify for and how those plans work, but they also take the time to show you what your individual case looks like, mapped out within each option. So if you're looking for help on your student loan debt or any area of personal finances, we recommend working with them. I use Varela Financial personally, and they were able to help me lower my student loan repayment from about $1,800 a month down to about $135 per month simply by finding the right repayment plan that best fit me, my family, and our life goals. You can check them out at VarelaFinancial.com. Link is in the show notes if you need it for reference, and tell them the HET podcast crew sent you. And now back to the show, you know?
Yeah, that can lead to trouble when we start to stand on a pedestal. The point, yeah, exactly what you said is it's all about patience. It's all about, okay, I made a mistake there. Let's make sure the patient's okay. Let's bring everybody in and say, okay, now what, you know, here's the new reality. Where do we go next?
Yeah.
And yeah, let's look back on how did that happen? There's a lot of processes. If big mistakes happen, thankfully nothing, I haven't had one of those yet, but it will happen. Yeah. I mean, it's just a statistical probability type.
The more you see, the bigger the opportunity to have one of those things, but you try to, you know, put the right steps in place so that it doesn't happen. But realistically, like you said, we are human and things happen. Yeah. And I think you hit on a really key point there, reflection. That's what really separates experts from novices a lot of times is the reflection ability to self-reflect and go back and look and see what worked well, what didn't, how do we improve it for the next time, what I would have done in certain situations. That reflection is key to learning anything, let alone, you know, that medicine. So let's look at the other side of the coin now. Let's look at maybe a practice that you saw or something that, you know, was a method of learning that wasn't very helpful. Like what was something that you went through schooling and you just thought like, man, I did not learn well because of that process or just that didn't click with me.
Yeah, I think it might come to just simple interest, what I'm interested in. That being said, I mean, radiology is my favorite hobby now.
When you find that thing you love, it's easy to geek out on, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so that's what I tell folks when anybody asks me what I do. I say, well, I'm a physician. I practice radiology, and you know the conversation ensues. But it really is, and I tell them, yeah, it's my favorite hobby. You know, of all the hobbies that we have, this is the hobby that I like the most. That being said, you know, there's crunch times where in order to get good at something, there's only one way to get good at it. And that's to do it all the time for a long period of time. And so if we're not enjoying that practice of whatever trade that we are in, it's going to weed us out on its own. It really is a favorite hobby. I thoroughly enjoy it. I just get it. Yeah. I was being pulled into urology and ortho as an intern because I was hustling. I was working my tail off in order to help the surgeons. that was, you know, in the OR, in the clinic, et cetera. And I just really enjoyed those mentalities of getting things done. And surgery is just neat in general. But I told both of those services, I was like, guys, I appreciate it. Love working with y'all, but I just dig radiology. And so, yeah, that's how I ended up in this fun trade.
All right. I've got a selfish question that I want to ask. And you have a little bit of a, I'll call it an experienced outlook on this because you have been through the military and you have, you know, military background. So my question to you is, as experts of musculoskeletal dysfunction and or movement sciences, do you feel that physical therapists should be allowed to order imaging?
Oh, that's a great question. That might be a case-by-case basis. I wouldn't want to hinder anybody to access ordering radiology necessarily. It's more along the lines of efficiency. So I don't know if I'm going to have a direct answer for your question, but it's more along the lines of, so this is what we deal with a lot in radiology, is just simple efficiency, is we want to make sure that the images that are ordered are indicated. In other words, are they going to help in the whole decision-making process? So every radiology exam is a test. It's a branch point of, all right, my management is going to go down one of these five pathways, for example. Is this test going to help us narrow that pathway down? And so that's really what it comes down to. Yeah. And if a physical therapist has the know-how, talking about any individual physical therapist, has the know-how on, okay, yeah, this management has a split point and this test should help, then that's great. And it could also be the point of, yeah, I mean, if there's any question at all, there's a great resource aside from simply calling a radiologist. You just call a radiologist and say, hey, here's my patient. Here's the deal. Should I do anything? So that's one way of doing it. The other way of doing it is there's an amazing bank library to answer that question for us that is updated, I believe, once a week based off of all research data. And it's called, so the American College of Radiology, the ACR, the bank is called the appropriateness criteria. And if anybody puts into any Google search or Bing or whatever, those terms, appropriateness criteria, what they're going to find is the ACR's appropriateness criteria. And if you scroll down and there's a button that says browse topics, what that opens up is a bunch of PDF forms that are categorized essentially by body part. So there'll be a breast section, a cardiac section, a chest section, neuro, et cetera. And for physical therapists, an MSK section, musculoskeletal. And what it does is it has a column of almost every clinical scenario. Let's say, for example, low back pain. All right. And so if you click into, it'll have the narrative and ratings table as a PDF. Click in that for whatever you're looking at. Again, let's use low back pain. Click in the narrative and ratings table, and that will open up a PDF. And within low back pain, there are a bunch of different variants, right? Acute onset,
yep.
Chronic, trauma, non-traumatic, history of malignancy, infection, all those variants. And underneath all those variants, it will have this imaging is appropriate. This imaging is maybe appropriate. This imaging is not appropriate. And it'll have that in a PDF format, which is super helpful. And then underneath those PDF charts, within the PDF, underneath those charts that we just talked about, you know, whether, you know, a lumbar spine radiograph or an MR, et cetera, it'll go into the weeds of all the data. And then at the bottom, it'll have a summary bullet point session. And I always like bullet points because yeah. They're succinct and efficient. So in order to answer one's question, that is an amazing bank. I use it as a radiologist.
I love
especially
that.
If somebody calls me and says, hey, I've got this, I've got that. What do you think? Should I order this and that? And a lot of times, actually every time, I'll point them to that and I'll say, let's look at it together to make sure that they can navigate it appropriately. So that's I guess my long-winded answer to your question. Now, should they be able to, I mean, I don't know. Again, that's going to be a case-by-case basis. I'm not a politician either, but if there's ever any question to, yeah, hopefully find a radiologist that one is comfortable with, because, you know, everybody's different. Some folks like to answer those kind of questions. Personally, I love it, but I know that a lot of radiologists don't want to be bothered. I think overall, that is changing toward let's be accessible.
Yeah.
That being said, a lot of times we're extremely busy, but by and large, yeah, reach out to a radiologist and or that bank and then go from there.
I love it. I love it. So here's kind of the reason I asked that question, right? The VA system, physical therapists are given a little more autonomy, right? They can order a couple of medications. They can order x-rays and imaging whenever they feel that it's necessary. But out in the real world, like just everyday outpatient type or hospital-based or whatever, you know, we've always kind of taken orders from doctors as far as physical therapy. You have to order, get an order, a physician's order that says like eval and treat for physical therapy, right? Well, we're moving away from that and we're getting direct access more and more and more, because if you just have low back pain or let's say shoulder pain and you just want to come in off the street and get treated by a physical therapist because you have a sore shoulder and you know that's something they can help with, we have some states, most states have some sort of direct access. So you can just do that, right? You can just come in. You don't need a doctor's script or order for physical therapy. We're trying to move more towards that. All 50 states are different. Everybody has different levels. Some have complete unfettered direct access for as long as they need. Some have like a 10 to 14 day window. They get it and then they have to get a doctor's script, right? It's all different. But with regards to x-ray and imaging, right, we've shown there's, you know, some pretty good research within the VA that physical therapists can differentiate and know a lot of the times which, you know, which form of imaging or radiology is needed, because they know this isn't a bone thing. It's not a fracture. We don't need an x-ray. We need an MRI for this, right? So like we know that split point that you were kind of talking about, and we're pretty decent at finding it. You know, we're pretty good at it. So like, that's another thing that we're now fighting for, if you will, like to try to get more access to, you know, becoming a little bit more independent, you know, clinically. We don't need to read the x-rays and you know, figure out what's going on. We still leave that to you guys, but we just want to be able to send patients for x-ray and imaging, you know, or whatever it may be, whatever form of, you know, radiology they need, because we know that it is going to help our case. It's going to help our decision-making. And you know, to me, it's a no-brainer.
Imaging is very helpful. You know, we're visual beings.
Right? And sometimes it's not, right? Sometimes we know that like, hey, an x-ray is not going to help this. Like you're wasting time and money and resources. Like let's go right to this or whatever it may be that we know is needed, you know?
So that's an interesting point. Yeah, that's a good point. That opens up a whole new area as to, again, the appropriateness of imaging, because we don't want to order unnecessary studies ever.
Right.
And we want to make sure that whatever is being ordered helps, that it's useful. Now, useful can come in the form of negative findings. That's very useful, right? Yeah, we can use specific examples, but again, pointing back to that that bank, that appropriateness criteria, and to use your example that you're talking about, most every time in the MSK field, since we're talking about physical therapy, we will almost always get plain films first before mm-hmm. any other imaging, because a lot of times the answer will be obtained from a plain film. One, they're fast, right? And with MSK and x-rays are minimal radiation, but especially in regards to MSK, we can, the limbs are not susceptible to radiation damage, as opposed to other fast growing areas, cells like the gut, et cetera. Anyways, a lot of times plain films are almost always the first step in any MSK imaging, because the detail, the pixelation, I don't know if we're going to beat that in physics in regards to plain film. Whereas MR is a modality that's used for usually very specific questions after plain films have been obtained. Let's say, for example, shoulder, like you were saying, somebody with shoulder pain and the plain films are normal. That's a great starting point to know, mm-hmm. okay, And when I say normal, I'm not talking about no fractures. I mean no arthrosis. The acromioclavicular joint and the glenohumeral joint are absolutely normal. The acromiohumeral interval is normal. So therefore, okay, if there is, let's say, a supraspinatus or infraspinatus concern that you're finding with your physical exam, with the limited range of motion, for example, in a patient, that okay, well, that interval is normal, so that's not contributing to a possible supraspinatus, infraspinatus injury. Okay, but I'm still concerned that it's there. Then that's when one goes to plain film, or sorry, MR,
MR, yeah.
and to see if there's any bursal surface
Yeah.
or
So
articular.
you're ruling out a bunch of things before moving on to the next deeper dive.
Right. And the reason for that is that, again, plain films are better for certain things. Ultrasound's better for certain things. MR is better for certain things. CT is better for certain things. There's not necessarily a hierarchy of imaging. It's just every imaging modality has its strengths and weaknesses. And so with all these tools at play, now we've got all these tools. Yeah. So
Yeah.
we figure out, all right, these things. And by and large, it's been figured out. And now we're just getting down to these really nitty-gritty details with further research and further data. That being said, yeah, an MR, it takes a long time. An average shoulder MRI, and that's if a group is moving very quickly, I want to say is going to be 30 minutes. And the patient has to be very still.
Oh yeah, I've
And
been there, done that. Not a good time. Not
so
excited.
that's a drawback of MR, is that, yeah, it takes a long time. It's very susceptible to motion artifact. Whereas plain films are, the blink of an eye. That's how fast they're obtained. It's just you're in the clinic for, what, 10 minutes, aside from waiting time. And so, again, they all have their positives and negatives. And that's where the knowledge of that's where talking to a radiologist and that appropriateness criteria come into play, is keeping all of those factors in mind.
Yeah.
If you've got a patient that, say, has Parkinson's, they're not going to be able to hold still aside from medication. And then you've got medication, and then you've got driver and all these logistics issues. And so it all plays into, is this going to help? And that is a conversation that we have with other physicians and other providers a lot. And that happens live. That happens after the fact, before the fact. So that's where we come into play, is that we're not just robots in a dark room, quote unquote, just reading images. I mean, we are doing procedures, we're talking to patients, we're doing the ultrasounds ourselves when the sonographers come in and say, I don't know what this is, or how can I help? But especially with MSK, like, we're the ones who know the anatomy. So we're going in, and then we can say, all right, this thing is next to this muscle and, just superficial to this neurovascular complex, and that really helps somebody else saying, okay, now I know exactly what's going on.
I love
So
that take, man. I love that.
when it comes to non-physicians ordering imaging, that's where a blanket statement, I think, is not going to suffice.
Yeah.
I think that really comes down to a case-by-case thing, where let's collaborate,
Yeah.
let's make sure that we do this right for Mrs. Smith, for Mr. Jones, that we're not having this person run all over kingdom come, that we can get it right the first time. And that doesn't happen all the time, but then we can
Right.
still say, Miss Smith, Mr. Jones, like, here's what's going on, and let's do this, and let's try this, because we're all in this together, right? Well, I mean, we're all patients. So yeah, let's just help each other out and make it efficient and voice everything that's going on. That's one other thing that I really like about what I do, is that, to quote the Big Lebowski, I feel like we're the rug that really ties the room together.
I
A
love
lot
that.
of times we're the ones who, tie the bow on the package and say, okay, let's grab this medicine note, and let's grab this surgical note, and let's say, okay, medicine, surgery, oncology, here's what the imaging says. And so a lot of times we're the ones who, I don't know if lead the conferences is the right word, but we're always a part of the conferences, because then we can take all this information and say, here's where this thing is, and here's what it looks like. It could be one of these three different things. Let's figure it out. I'll biopsy it. We'll see what path says, and then we'll go from there and see how the treatment's going. So
Yeah,
we're
you're
really a
the
part
connector.
of everything. Yeah, we're kind of
Yeah.
maybe a keystone. I don't know.
Yeah.
Hopefully we're helpful.
I love it. I love it. Well, Chris, thank you so much for your time, man, and for coming on the show and just sharing your knowledge with our audience about all things radiology. We ask all of our guests this one final question, and that question is, if you could change one aspect of higher education, whether it be medicine or otherwise, what aspect would you change and how would you change it?
One of the things that I like to teach, and I learned that through the years. And one thing that I really like to share with whoever I'm sitting with or whoever's sitting with me, whatever, is that I like to share all the things that I wish I had known at that stage, whatever stage that may be. And I like to use that a lot. I like to say, for example, Scotty, all right, you're going to want to know this because this was super helpful in this manner. Here's a trick that I learned along the way that I wish I had known beforehand, but maybe that is, again, just learning. You know, we have to, there's a certain portion of things that can be taught to us, but there's a large part that we just have to figure out
experience
by going through the grind. And I think the knowledge of that is really well perceived already by the folks that have gone through this grind, is that the grind is the learning, is that I don't think I've met a resident that doesn't know that. They understand that, yeah, there's only really one way to learn this, and that's just to do it all the time. And so that might be something that I would convey to anybody going or thinking of going into this trade, is that get ready to just go to learn all the time, that it doesn't stop. The discipline of getting the work done is the goal, and helping people is the goal, and not just patients, but helping our cohort, helping our peers. That's one of my favorite aspects of the job right now, is when a physical therapist calls and says, all right, I got this patient. And I say, all right, yeah, let's think about this. All right, so what about that? What about that? It's the collaboration's super fun.
Yeah.
Another banner that we talked about earlier, it's not about me. You know, this is not a pride thing. This is not a, hey, look at me and, you know, what I've done. That's never been a part of it. It's all about, yeah, let's just get this done and go and help people out.
Yeah, I love that take on it, because realistically, you know, I like to give tips, tricks, and pointers from an expert when I teach, right? I like to tell them stories that have happened to me in real life that may help them in the future.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, like you said, some of the stuff, they just have to do the reps. They have to get in. It's like, you know, working out chest muscles, like you got to get under the bar and do the reps, right? It's just the only way it's going to happen. So in order to get to some point of like pattern recognition, you have to have enough patterns seen to be able to recognize.
That's it. Know? Yeah. You'll notice an abnormal chest x-ray after you've seen 10,000 normals.
Right. Right.
And you see 10,000 normals and then an abnormal pops up, your brain goes, there's something going on right here. Yeah.
1,000%. I love that. So yeah, man, I mean, that's a great take. And I do, like I said, I like sharing stories like that. I feel like we learn better through storytelling. That's a big point of mine. And so I share a lot of clinical stories and pearls, if you will. But they also have to realize the other side of that coin is I got decent at that and I got pretty good at it by the reps. So
put in.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's only one way to get good at this stuff. That's to do it all the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's fun.
I love it. I love it, man. Thank you so much for your time and for coming on here.
Thank you.
Where can people find you online or reach out to you if they have questions or follow up or just want to know a little bit more about the world of radiology?
Yeah, sure. I guess just email would be the easiest way to go. And then in the title, because we all get, you know, 100 emails a day, so I'm deleting very quickly sometimes. I would say, put in the, well, my email address is cbhartness@gmail.com. So that's Charlie, Bravo, Hotel, Alpha, Romeo, Tango, November, Echo, Sierra. And in the old school ways of spelling.
Yeah, you've spoken like a true army man.
And at gmail.com. And I would say put in the subject line something along the lines of like, radiology question, Yeah, and I'll be happy to shoot stuff back. Maybe we can talk on the phone.
Yeah, awesome. We'll put that in the show notes so everybody can find that easily. Chris,
cool.
Thanks so much, man. It was an absolute pleasure catching back up with you.
Scotty, likewise. Thank you for the opportunity. Keep doing what you're doing.
Will do. Will do, my man. Well, I hope that episode was entertaining as much as it was informational and educational. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our past episodes, we ask you to please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating and review. And please share out the episodes to those who you feel may be able to benefit from them. We also urge you to follow us on all social media platforms at HET Podcast and let us know what topics or experts you would like to hear from in future episodes. And just as a reminder, none of the information on today's show should be considered medical advice. It's simply infotainment or edutainment to help educate our audience. For medical advice, we always advise you to reach out to your preferred medical professionals, and we'll see you on the next show.